I'm Graham Smith. I'm the head of obstetrics and gynecology at Queen's University in the Kingston Health Sciences Center in Kingston, Ontario. We established the Mothers Program to provide a reliable source of information about pregnancy on the internet with the goal to improve mothers' health through education, research, and screening. The Mothers podcasts are an extension of that. Today we're going to be discussing thinking about a vaginal birth after a cesarean section, and our guest is Dr. Jessica D. Dr. D is an associate professor at the University of Ottawa and at the Ottawa Hospital. Dr. D is also the lead author on the SOGC's guideline for VBAC. Jessica, welcome and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
So having a cesarean section is a common mode of delivery in Canada. Depending on where you are, about 25% of all births occur by cesarean section. And while pregnant women have no control over what their uterus does or doesn't do in labor, or whether their baby does or doesn't tolerate labor, they can make decisions in subsequent pregnancies on how they might want to try to deliver. Any thoughts before we delve into some questions that they need to consider when making this decision?
I'm really glad that you've chosen this topic for your podcast. It is a very important discussion for women to have with themselves, with their partners, and with their care providers. And I really firmly believe that if they're armed with the most up-to-date information, that they will hopefully come up with a good decision and a good plan for their current pregnancy.
So there's two terms that are used, VBAC and TOLAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, and trial of labor after cesarean. Can you explain the difference or why there are two terms?
Yes, absolutely. So these two terms have been previously used interchangeably or even synonymously, when in fact they refer to two very distinct different things. So VBAC, as you mentioned, is vaginal birth after cesarean, really refers to the birth outcome after someone's had a cesarean section. And TOLAC really refers to that plan to labor after someone's had a prior cesarean, with the intention at the end of this labor to have a vaginal birth or a VBAC. So in the past, people used to refer to a successful VBAC as a VBAC. And that really, I find, is quite redundant, because a successful VBAC is a vaginal birth. And then we also used to use the words a failed VBAC. And that really refers to a trial of labor after cesarean that ended up with a repeat cesarean section.
So let's take a common clinical scenario. A woman ends up with a cesarean section in labor because, say, she doesn't get beyond 8 centimeters dilated, or even she does get to 10 centimeters fully dilated, but because of the position of the baby or the size of the baby, it just doesn't come down into the pelvis and was too high for an assisted vaginal delivery. So what do you talk about with that individual when they ask about a trial of labor, and what's their chances of success?
This is a really common scenario, as you know, a very, very difficult and challenging to have a very thorough discussion with no real absolute guarantees. I often start the conversation with a woman with stating the fact that whatever factors that were present with her first pregnancy may very well be present again this time around. The difference being is that the risks for her and for her baby with this pregnancy, if she decides to labor, are slightly different and a little bit higher, mainly because she's had the previous cesarean section. So I really like to focus on then what are the variables this time around that may make it different, that may either increase or reduce her chances of having a vaginal birth.
So are there clinical scenarios where the chance of success is higher or lower in subsequent pregnancies?
So absolutely. So we do know that if a woman who's had a previous cesarean section is going into labor spontaneously, if she has no other complications in pregnancy, such as preeclampsia or a small for gestational age baby, or if she does not need to be induced this time around, then her chances of having a vaginal birth are usually higher. Now, if someone's going past their due date, you know, if they're now 40 or 41 weeks gestation, if they have a very unfavorable cervix, they need to be induced in that setting, then their chances are usually lower.
So let's say in her last pregnancy, she had a cesarean section for a breech presentation. She chose that route for delivery. Is her chance of success in a subsequent pregnancy of a vaginal delivery higher than if, say, she had a cesarean section for failure to progress or failure for, say, a non-reassuring fetal heart rate?
So we consider breech presenting baby to be a non-recurring event. So in that situation, then her chance with the next pregnancy for having a vaginal birth will be an average vaginal birth probability for any first-time mom. So that would be anywhere from, 70 to 80% for all comers. Whereas if she's had, in her previous labor, she's had labor and she got to 8 centimeters or she even got to 10 and started pushing, those same variables may be present, then this time around, her chances of vaginal birth may be lower compared to that woman who had a breech baby for the first time.
If someone was to rupture their uterus, what would be the signs or symptoms that the health professionals are watching for?
So this is, again, a hard question because there is no one single sign or symptom that actually suggests or predicts that a uterine rupture will be happening. We may have no warning signs at all, but some of the common signs that we do see if a uterine rupture was happening would be excessive bleeding from the mom, excessive pain that is unusual for a labor pattern type of pain, if we had an abnormal fetal heart rate pattern. So those are some of the common things that we would be looking for that would suggest a uterine rupture.
So having a previous cesarean section does increase the chance of the uterus coming apart during pregnancy, most of which occurs in labor if it's going to happen, but it can happen before labor. Are there things that change the risk of this happening?
We do know that most uterine ruptures do happen in labor. And so some of the things that increase that risk of happening would be if someone's had more than one cesarean section. If their inter-pregnancy or inter-delivery interval was less than 18 months, if they were, at the time of labor, were to use oxytocin or prostaglandins. So these are some of the clinical factors that does increase that risk. It has been seen that uterine rupture can happen before labor. And these are usually the settings where a defect in the lower uterine segment has been identified, either early on in the pregnancy or potentially even before pregnancy. And that's usually through an ultrasound assessment of the uterine wall.
So just to clarify, is it 18 months from delivery to getting pregnant the next time, or 18 months from when they deliver the first time to when they deliver the next time?
So the inter-delivery pregnancy would be the delivery of the first pregnancy and the expected delivery date of this current pregnancy. So from baby birth to baby birth.
Recognizing that the use of intravenous oxytocin, as you said, does increase the risk of uterine rupture, what about having like a plan A and a plan B? For instance, let's say plan A was if you went into labor on your own, which is the lowest risks, maybe trying a VBAC is a good plan. But if you don't go into labor on your own and don't want an induction that increases your chance of uterine rupture, having a plan B, which might be, okay, I'm going to book an elective repeat cesarean section at my due date or a week after my due date. I think it's important that people keep an open mind and have, different plans in place so that they, are not disappointed in the end when it doesn't work out the way that they hope.
I totally agree, and I'm glad you brought that up because I often have a plan A, a B, C, and even a D sometimes for some women, right? And as you mentioned, plan A for those women who want to have a vaginal birth or a VBAC would be exactly like you said. If they go into labor on their own, if there's no interventions that's really needed and they're laboring on their own and get to fully in pushing, that's definitely plan A for most women wanting a VBAC. And then you start discussing your plan B and C. If they've gone into labor and yet their labor stalls, for example, would they be open to the use of oxytocin knowing the risks are there? Or a plan C, if they break their water, for example, and that's a common scenario as well. They break their water at, say, 38 or 39 weeks, everything else being normal. What would they want to do in that situation, considering induction or not? And then also the question of what their cervix is doing. Is it a favorable cervix at the start of that conversation? What are the things that you would need to do to get them into labor if they were considering that? And then plan D is often that exact scenario. You're now a week past your due date. Nothing's happening. You have a cervix that's long, close, and posterior. So what do we do? And often most women are actually very reasonable. They know that their chances of vaginal birth in that scenario, in that setting, are the lowest of all of those different scenarios. Then some women opt to choose, yes, let's have a backup date. Let's book it for whatever date they're comfortable with and go with that. And then they're definitely going towards the end of their pregnancy, knowing that there are multiple scenarios that can play out. And you're ready as you can be with whatever happens over the next, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of the last 3 weeks of their pregnancy.
What advice would you give to somebody who wants a vaginal delivery, regardless of the risks, and is willing to have an induction with oxytocin or augmentation of labor with oxytocin? What's the actual chance that a woman has a uterine rupture, and what's the risk associated with the oxytocin?
Right. So I usually start that conversation with all comers, all women who have had a previous cesarean section. The estimated baseline risk for uterine rupture is about 0.5% or 1 in 200 or 5 in 1,000. I kind of present it in many different ways. But it all comes down to that 0.5% baseline risk if they had labor and they've had a prior cesarean section. Then I add in some of the common things that might happen or one might anticipate with this pregnancy. For example, using oxytocin for augmentation or induction. And the use of oxytocin has been associated with what I usually use the word doubling the risk. So now you're going from 0.5% to 1%. And again, I always emphasize that these are estimates. These are all comers, and there may be other factors related to their specific pregnancy that may either increase or decrease that risk. With the use of other induction agents such as prostaglandins or Cervidil or Prostin, those are some of the common things we use, then that risk is even higher than the oxytocin. We're now looking at potentially a risk of up to 2 to 3% with the use of these agents. And now then I talk about that theoretical additive or cumulative risks if all of these things are happening. And those are just not that easy to quantify at that point when you have multiple risks added together.
Okay, what about someone wanting a home birth after a cesarean section? I know if a uterine rupture occurs, you know, it's somewhat unpredictable. And so having a home birth, you know, or having a uterine rupture when trying to have a home birth could be potentially catastrophic in terms of the effects on both mom and baby. What would you say to the woman who asked you about that?
So I often say that they need to have a very thorough discussion with their care provider. In this setting, it's usually a midwife who's able to offer birth at the birth center or at home. And I often emphasize that the ability to monitor the baby, the fetal heart rate, is really not the same as if they were laboring and birthing in a hospital. They would not be able to have that continuous fetal monitoring in the home or birth center setting. And that's really the only way we can really look at how baby is tolerating labor. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the signs of a potential uterine rupture would be an abnormal fetal heart rate pattern. So they need to discuss this scenario with their provider and also discuss the plan. So they need to have a backup plan again. I usually compare this to driving a car with an almost empty tank of gas. They need to know where the closest gas station is and how long it will take them to get there. What sort of warning lights that they would like to see on their dashboard for them to call on these emergency services, and to really know and understand that there's always inherent delays during that transport. So in the event that they should need an emergency cesarean section, there are those delays that sometimes we just cannot avoid, and that may affect the outcome for them or their baby.
Are there any resources that people can look to help them make those decisions?
There are tons of resources online on the internet. One of the things I often refer them to is the a VBAC calculator, as a, you know, for some women who want to have a specific number to give them a percent or a probability of vaginal birth. So there are VBAC prediction models that are out there, that some that are validated. And then there are decision aids, decision tools that are out there. So SOGC, I believe, has come up with an education pamphlet or tool that comes with a short version of a decision aid to help patients go through this thought process.
Any final thoughts or advice that you want to give to women and their partners?
Every birth experience is different. So in the context of a woman who's had a previous C-section, the goal is really for them to have a positive experience this time around. And whether that positive experience comes with a plan for a repeat cesarean section, or if it comes with a plan for a trial of labor, recognizing that that may result with either a vaginal birth or a cesarean section. And really, at the end of the day, what I try to impart to moms and their partners is that all we want, and I think we're all together in this, is all we want at the end of the day is to have a healthy mom and a healthy baby to go home.
Thank you, Jessica, for taking the time to join us to talk about vaginal birth after having a cesarean section. I want to thank our guest, as well as Adelaide Burrows, who helped to produce this podcast and for those behind the scenes. We will put some of the links that Dr. D talked about in terms of VBAC calculator, decision aids, and some of the SOGC educational tools on our website, www.themothersprogram.ca. The Mothers Program is all one word. If you have any comments, suggestions, or ideas for topics or people that we should interview, please use the contact section on our website. Until next time, be safe.